American Free Press Audio Edition, number 45 and 46, November 4th and 11th, 2019. Pathologist says Epstein murdered respected medical examiner alleges injuries to famed pedophile consistent with homicide, by Paul Angel. Former New York City medical examiner Dr. Michael Bodden, who has worked on high-profile cases during a five-decade medical career, contends that the wounds suffered by multimillionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein are not consistent with suicide but point to homicide. Bodden, who was hired by Epstein's brother and had read over the medical examiner's report and attended the autopsy, dropped the bombshell news on October 30. In an exclusive interview with Fox News, Bodden said Epstein, who was 66 at the time of his death, had two fractures on the left and right sides of his larynx, specifically the thyroid cartilage or Adam's apple, as well as one fracture on the left hyoid bone above the Adam's apple. He added, "Those three fractures are extremely unusual in suicidal hangings and could occur much more commonly in homicidal strangulation." On August 10, Epstein, who was being held at the high-security Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan in New York City pending a trial where he faced multiple counts of trafficking in minors, was reportedly found hanging in his prison cell. He was later declared dead. Epstein was on suicide watch at the time of his death, allegedly because of a previous suicide attempt. New York authorities have claimed Epstein killed himself, despite the fact that no guards witnessed it. At the time, cameras that were supposedly watching Epstein's every move had also mysteriously shut down. Bodden did say that he did not have enough evidence at this time to conclusively determine that Epstein was murdered, though he added that the three fractures were extremely rare. "I've not seen in 50 years where that occurred in a suicidal hanging case," he said. According to Fox News, Bodden is considered by many to be a legend among medical examiners. He has examined more than 20,000 bodies and hosted HBO's autopsy television series that explored in-depth medical exams around the country. "If a person weighed 120 pounds and their head weighed 10 pounds, he told Fox, "you would expect there to be 110 pounds of pressure on the neck of the jaw during a hanging. If someone put their hands around a person's neck and squeezed, however, that would lead to significantly more pressure. There's evidence here of homicide that should be investigated, to see if it is or isn't homicide," Bodden concluded. Of course, these revelations come as no surprise to AFP readers, but they do offer some much welcome official affirmation to those who contended, and even predicted, that Epstein, a man with a long list of prominent, powerful people listed in his little black book, was murdered and would never live to face justice in a court of law. Do Dems want that can of worms opened? This week, Democrats ratcheted up calls for impeachment by formally introducing legislation that lays out the specific process for impeachment proceedings. The House voted on the measure on October 31, effectively formalizing this attempted ouster of President Donald Trump. The bill passed along party lines with only two Democrats voting against it. The Democrats who voted no were Reps. Colin Peterson, Min, and Jefferson Van Drew, NJ, both of whom represent District Trump won in the 2016 election. Rep. Justin Amash, I. Mitch, who left the GOP earlier this year because of Trump, voted for the measure. Republicans were quick to denounce the move as nothing more than a political stunt that is intended to hamstring the White House and smear the president in the lead-up to the 2020 elections. They are not wrong here. The overwhelming majority of mainstream media outlets despise Trump, largely because he refuses to mince words when it comes to calling out their bias and their dishonesty. There can be no doubt that the largest media outlets in the U.S. will be tripping over each other to report every little juicy rumor that pops up without a care in the world as to their veracity. Working with their allies in the media, Democrats will then do what they can to cash in on this trashing of the president, because they know that is really the only way they'll be able to beat him in 2020. Does anyone honestly think that the current Democratic roster of top-tier presidential contenders will be able to beat Trump in a presidential race? By now, all of the worst accusations have already been flung at the president, and he's survived them all. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren have never appealed to the man in the street like Trump does, by pledging support for lax immigration laws, high taxes, and socialist policies in the Democratic primaries. Whoever wins the Democratic ticket will be entering the presidential race against Trump at a serious disadvantage, especially in more conservative states like Wisconsin that will be vital if the Democrats want to take back the White House. But the Democrats are playing a very dangerous game. Despite what their apologists and useful idiots in the media say, everyone knows the Bidens are corrupt and, like so many in the top echelons of government, have for years exploited their power and privilege to enrich themselves. Think about it for a second. The allegation made by the Democrats is that Trump threatened to withhold military aid to Ukraine if the Ukrainians did not investigate corruption in their government, specifically as it related to Joe Biden's son, Hunter, as well as the origins of the Russiagate probe. The story behind Hunter was that he had reportedly been kicked out of the U.S. Navy for illicit drug use right before he was offered a cushy $50,000 a month job with a Ukrainian oil company, despite having no experience in that field. Joe Biden later had the audacity to brag that he personally had a Ukrainian prosecutor fired, who had been sniffing around the sweetheart deal his son received from the company, Burisma. And then there is the strange case of the Ukrainian servers that were supposedly used to hack into email servers maintained by the Democratic National Committee, DNC, exposing the emails of top Democrats, who were working to undermine Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders's presidential campaign. Trump has asked the Ukrainians to work with U.S. investigators and turn these servers over to them, unless someone has something to hide. Why wouldn't everyone in Washington support this? Do the Democrats really believe that they'll come out of this fight clean? On its face, you have Washington insiders defending individuals who have used their positions of power to benefit themselves and their families and then going after a president who is trying to root out corruption in Washington to drain the swamp. How do they think this is going to play out all across the United States of America? The nasty truth of the matter is out there. The UNS Review recently interviewed a former member of the Ukrainian parliament and a candidate for Ukraine's presidency, Oleg Serov, who talked at length about how U.S. and European officials effectively looted Ukraine of its natural resources and wealth. Here's the most salient part of what Serov had to say about all of this. John Kerry, the Secretary of State in Obama's administration, was Vice President Joe Biden's partner in crime. But Biden was number one. During the Obama presidency, Biden was the U.S. proconsul for Ukraine, and he was involved in many corruption schemes. He authorized the transfer of $3 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money to the post-coup government of Ukraine. The money was stolen, and Biden took a big share of the spoils. It is a story of ripping the U.S. taxpayer and the Ukrainian customer off for the benefit of a few corruptioners, American and Ukrainian. There was a time when media outlets had a stranglehold on information and could stop this type of information from getting out, but those days are long over. Today, in the day of the internet, it's all but impossible to keep this under wraps by the people who despise Trump and are willing to lie and cheat just to see him go down. We at AFP will continue to report the truth no matter where it takes us. If nothing else, the lead up to the presidential election in 2020 will be very interesting. And we'll be right there, giving you, our readers, an inside seat to what's really going on in the ring. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, Warmonger Queen says Gabbard a Russian agent. By St. Patrick, it has been firmly established beyond any doubt that it is now literally impossible for an American political figure to vocally oppose U.S. warmongering without being labeled a Russian agent. This was an October 19th tweet from News analyst Caitlin Johnston regarding Hillary Clinton's thinly veiled insinuation that presidential contender Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, D. Hawaii, is a Russian asset. On a podcast with former Barack Obama advisor David Plouffe, Clinton said that the Russians are grooming a Democratic candidate to represent their interests in the 2020 campaign. I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who is currently in the Democratic primary and her grooming her to be the third-party candidate, Clinton said. She's the favorite of the Russians. The Clinton team followed the interview by pointing out that Gabbard's anti-war foreign policy goals closely align with the Russians. Gabbard, who served in a medical unit and is a veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq, didn't take Clinton's remarks lightly. She took to Twitter to blast the 2016 presidential loser, tweeting, "Thank you at Hillary Clinton, you, the queen of warmongers, embodiment of corruption, and personification of the rot that has sickened the Democratic Party for so long, have finally come out from behind the curtain. From the day I announced my candidacy, there has been a concerted campaign to destroy my reputation. We wondered who was behind it and why. Now we know, it was always you, through your proxies and powerful allies in the corporate media and war machine, afraid of the threat I pose. It's now clear that this primary is between you and me. Don't cowardly hide behind your proxies. Join the race directly." That Clinton's unfounded comments were about Gabbard and not any of the other women in the Democratic race was the worst-kept secret since Ross Perot finally decided to run for president in 1992. So, when Gabbard responded to the comments that were obviously about her, Clinton's team called her a conspiracy theorist. Clinton spokesman Nick Merrill said, "Divisive language filled with vitriol and conspiracy theories. Can't imagine a better proof point than this." Clinton hasn't been the only entity claiming Gabbard is a Russian asset. There has been an almost unified effort on the part of the mainstream media to discredit Gabbard's anti-war, anti-Russiagate stances. The New York Times claimed she was being supported by Russians on Twitter, and one CNN commentator directly stated that she was a Russian asset. "Completely despicable," Gabbard said of the attacks. "For the most part, Gabbard's challengers in the Democratic primaries have been silent in responding to Clinton's attacks." One Democratic candidate that came to Gabbard's defense was Senator Bernie Sanders, IVT. "Tulsi Gabbard has put her life on the line to defend this country," Sanders tweeted. "People can disagree on issues, but it is outrageous for anyone to suggest that Tulsi is a foreign asset." In recent months, Gabbard has criticized U.S. policy in Syria. She has said she would release Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning while allowing Edward Snowden to return home without legal turmoil, and she has expressed concern that the impeachment inquiry is going on behind closed doors. Gabbard has also been at the forefront of Democrats who are appalled at the new McCarthyism that is spreading like a virus throughout their party. When the specific Russiagate collusion hoax proved unsubstantiated, a wider McCarthyism rose from its ashes. "There is no proof required to level an accusation of being a Russian asset. One must simply be anti-war, especially in Syria, and must espouse some level of dissatisfaction with the Democratic National Committee, DNC, supporting Assange, who may have actually leaked the Clinton Podesta emails in 2016 that showed how the DNC was secretly undermining Bernie Sanders, is just the thick icing on the red cake needed to label someone a Russian sympathizer, wittingly or unwittingly doing the business of the Kremlin. Whether this is a shot across the bow, an opening salvo, in preparation for a Clinton 2020 campaign to commence has yet to be seen." Last week, former Clinton advisor Dick Morris said, "If you feel a pulse, you know Hillary's going to run, but Gabbard is tough." In a lighter moment amidst the barrage, she tweeted, "Never confuse aloha for weakness, end of accountable government is nigh." By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. For about 70 years the CIA has been undermining a free press. It began with Operation Mockingbird, a Cold War operation against communism. Via Mockingbird, the CIA recruited journalists into its propaganda network. The CIA paid journalists to write fake stories or to publish stories written by the CIA in order to control explanations that served the agency's agendas. Students in cultural organizations and intellectual magazines, such as Encounter, were suborned into the CIA's propaganda network. Thanks to the German journalist Udo Ofkat, we know that every European journalist of any significance is a CIA asset. In 1977, Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame wrote in Rolling Stone that the CIA has secretly bankrolled numerous foreign press services, periodicals, and newspapers, both English and foreign language, which provided excellent cover for CIA operatives. Like most other people, Western journalists were all too willing to sell out their integrity for money. The few who were not were blackmailed into submission. The few honest journalists who remain have been forced out of the mainstream or prostitute media onto internet websites. WikiLeaks is by far the best news organization of our time. to bring this organization to heel, Washington, using its Swedish, British, and Ecuadorian vassals, has persecuted WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for years. The CIA's media vassals, including the New York Times and The Guardian, both of which published the material leaked to WikiLeaks that is being used to destroy Assange, have joined wholeheartedly in the persecution of the world's best and most honest journalist. Currently, Assange is being tortured, apparently to death, while being held in solitary confinement in a maximum security British prison awaiting his extradition to the US on false charges. As the CIA cannot be certain it has suborned all the federal judges, Washington is just as happy if Assange dies in a British prison, as there is no valid case against him under current US law. Probably the absence of a valid case doesn't matter, as the rule of law in the US is very difficult to find. The lack of any valid case against Assange is the reason the distinguished documentary filmmaker John Pilger describes Assange's persecution as a Stalinist show trial. What is astonishing about the CIA's destruction of Julian Assange is the silence of American law schools and bar associations, the silence of universities, the absence of student and labor union protests, the absence of any protection of Assange's rights from courts as the last news organization willing and capable of holding governments accountable for their crimes is destroyed openly in full view of the law schools, intellectuals, bar associations, courts, and print and TV media. The CIA's control over explanations is as complete as the control Big Brother has in George Orwell's dystopian novel, 1984, and this doesn't bother the citizens of the US, UK, Australia, Canada, Sweden, Europe. Only a few individuals speak out for Assange, and they, too, are demonized in turn. Meet the shills of fake news, political connections, not skill. Got these mainstream news icons their jobs, the shills of fake news, by Donald Jeffries. Considering how many Americans pay high tuition costs every year for college degrees in journalism, or go to expensive broadcasting schools, it is instructive to look at the backgrounds of those at the highest levels of the media. On CNN alone, Anderson Cooper is the son of 1%er Gloria Vanderbilt and was a CIA college recruit for good measure. Chris Cuomo is the son of former politician Mario Cuomo and brother of current New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Among the network's senior advisors are former Barack Obama aide David Axelrod and former White House fellow under Hillary Clinton Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Chief Washington correspondent Jake Tapper started out as press secretary for Democratic congressional candidate Marjorie Margolis Mezvinsky, and worked for a public relations firm run by Jimmy Carter's press secretary, Jody Powell, as well as Handgun Control Incorporated. Several among CNN's on-air talents sit on the boards of big corporations, an all-too-common practice this author exposed in the book Survival of the Richest, CAFP's book catalog inside this issue. For more, add, not only do these positions provide lucrative part-time income, they represent a clear conflict of interest. MSNBC's Morning Joe program is hosted by former Republican Rep. Joe Scarborough, in whose office a dead young female aide was found shortly before his political career ended, an incident which has never been investigated and rarely reported on. His co-host is Mika Brzezinski, daughter of globalist extraordinaire Zbigniew Brzezinski. Former Bill Clinton advisor George Stephanopoulos is a reporter for ABC News. Former Bush aide Karl Rove works for Fox News. Former Clinton aide James Carville has worked for both CNN and Fox News. The pipeline goes both ways. Donald Trump hired Fox News's Larry Kudlow, and according to The Hill, during Obama's first term alone, 25 former reporters joined his administration. The staffs of politicians like Senator John Kerry have long been littered with ex-journalists. Chris Matthews got a start working for former Democratic Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. Regardless of their backgrounds, most mainstream journalists have proven to be not only devoid of any true investigative zeal, but utterly capable of smearing and destroying innocent lives. Richard Jewell was lambasted in the press as the Atlanta Olympics bomber, when in fact he was a genuine hero. His early death was undoubtedly at least partially triggered by the non-stop negative press coverage. Recently, the Des Moines Register dredged up some texts from young cancer fundraiser Carson King, when he was just 16, and demonized him for the public good. Predictably, these texts were deemed racist, and Anheuser-Busch, which had been matching contributions to his cause, immediately severed ties with King. The paper initially stood behind their reprehensible actions, but then it came out that reporter Aaron Colvin, who penned the article, had written far worse things on his own social media accounts. Colvin was eventually fired, but he blamed right-wing ideologues, and claimed he was being oppressed like women and journalists of color. Former ESPN reporter turned Fox Nation contributor Britt McHenry, who had an embarrassing video of her own go viral a few years back, in which she shamefully bullied a low-paid woman, expressed her outrage that a white male would dare to compare himself to officially designated oppressed groups, tweeting eloquently, "Wait, hold the expletive deleted, up, he dares to compare himself to receiving the vitriol women or people of color get on here?" During the first Gulf War, CNN was caught staging fake missile attacks. Nothing happened to any of those involved. Katie Couric was shown to have creatively edited responses during a special on gun control, and again her reputation didn't suffer in the least. MSNBC disgracefully edited a conversation between George Zimmerman and a police dispatcher, in an effort to portray Zimmerman as a racist. Recently, ABC News was caught airing unrelated footage in an attempt to show that any proposed withdrawal of troops from Syria, as proposed by President Donald Trump, would be devastating. Few Americans remember Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Janet Cook, who won the award for a Washington Post story that was subsequently discovered to have been entirely fabricated. Her academic credentials were later discovered to have been bogus. Jason Blair made up stories for the New York Times. Sabrina Erdley invented a non-existent rape at the University of Virginia for Rolling Stone magazine. There are many other examples, including the case of NBC's Brian Williams, who fabricated a bogus tale about his experiences in Iraq and got caught. After telling it to thousands of viewers, the same journalists, who worked for the politicians they cover for, enjoy hefty salaries for attending a few board meetings for companies they cover, hold an antipathy for any questioning of our corrupt authorities, which they instantly brand conspiracy theories, but they will camp that on an average person's doorstep and badger their families in an effort to expose the truth about some mundane matter. They are gutless, well-connected, and state-controlled. Media bias clear on impeachment Dems, controlled press have brought war against president to appalling heights. By Donald Jeffries, the recent secret testimony of acting U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor was breathlessly reported to be damning to President Donald Trump. Taylor testified behind closed doors, however, in secret impeachment hearings presided over by Rep. Adam Schiff, D. Califf. Selective leaks focused exclusively on Taylor's opening statement and failed to include any of the cross-examination from Republican representatives. Establishment reaction was quick and predictable. The New York Times described Taylor's nearly 10 hours of testimony as by far the most damning account yet to become public in the House impeachment inquiry. Mr. Taylor described a president holding up $391 million in assistance for the clear purpose of forcing Ukraine to help incriminate Mr. Trump's domestic rivals. Dana Milbank of The Washington Post claimed this of the testimony that shook Washington, in the words of so many mainstream journalists, in an instant. The impeachment inquiry no longer rested on the credibility or motives of a whistleblower. That whistleblower, of course, is the still unidentified CIA employee, who was not blowing the whistle on the CIA, and thus shouldn't reasonably be described as one. The reality is, Taylor, who has never met or even spoken with Trump, simply passed on third or fourth hand information, much like the whistleblower, that there was indeed a quid pro quo between the president and Ukraine, in which American aid would be withheld unless there was an investigation into the corruption of Joe Hunter Biden. Taylor claimed that he'd been told this by senior National Security Director Tim Morrison, who reportedly heard it from U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland. Sondland, however, disputed this, and it contradicted his own earlier closed-door testimony before Schiff. Sondland told The Washington Post, through his attorney, that he did not recall conversations recounted by Taylor in his House deposition. Thankfully, Some clear heads are pushing back against the mainstream media's bogus narrative. Rep. John Ratcliffe, R. Texas, declared on Fox News is the story. At the end of the day, this was about quid pro quo and whether or not the Ukrainians were aware that military aid was being withheld, and on that most important issue, neither this witness nor any other witness has provided any evidence that there was a quid pro quo, or any evidence that the Ukrainians were aware that military aid was being withheld on July 25th. The mainstream media reporting that he provided evidence of a quid pro quo involving military aid is false. I questioned him directly on that. I can't tell you what he said, but I can tell you what he didn't say. Neither he nor any other witness has provided testimony that the Ukrainians were aware that military aid was being withheld. Republicans called for Taylor's full testimony to be released, as Rep. Devin Nunes, R. Califf, told Fox News' Sean Hannity. The truth is, in 2 minutes, John Ratcliffe destroyed this witness. There is no quid pro quo. Rep. Mark Meadows, RNC, lamented that the leaks out of today's witness interview have been laughably overblown and don't tell the full story. Still no evidence of quid pro quo. Much of the statement and hearsay allegations didn't hold up against any real scrutiny. The full transcript should be released immediately, Trump reiterated Ratcliffe's main point, and added, where is the whistleblower? The do nothing Dems case is dead. More significantly, Rep. Adam Schiff's, D. Califf, House Intel Committee staffer Thomas Eager met with Taylor in the Ukraine on August 25 on a trip sponsored by the Atlanta Council, which is an official partner of Burisma. Hunter Biden sat on the board of Burisma. It was only 3 days later, on August 28, that Politico published a story about the possible withholding of aid based upon a leak from a senior administration official. Coincidence? As one of the all-time great conspirators, Franklin D. Roosevelt, once said, nothing in politics happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. 24 Republicans, reacting to Schiff's closed-door impeachment hearings, which they bemoaned as a Soviet-style process, were described as storming the October 24 session by the mainstream media. They appeared to be taking Trump's recent advice to get tough and fight for him, as they breached House security rules, shouting let us in and forced their way into the hearing, resulting in witness testimony being delayed for 5 hours. Every member of Congress ought to be allowed in that room. The press ought to be allowed in that room, declared Rep. Steve Scalise, RLA. One Republican participating in the hearings, Rep. Jim Jordan, R. Ohio, said, it's finally reached the point where members just said they were so frustrated at the idea that they can't be a part of this and see what's going on. Founders battled over impeachment, ridding America of its executive extends to founding fathers. By S.T. Patrick, it's difficult to imagine Ben Franklin, James Madison, and Patrick Henry concerned with impeachment. The infant newspapers of the day, including the First American Daily, the Pennsylvania Packet and Daily Advertiser, had only dreamed of reaching the scope and influence of a USA Today or New York Times. Yet, the founding fathers had disengaged themselves from a mother country and her king. They had dealt intimately with the follies of royal appointees throughout their lives. When in 1787 these men gathered in Philadelphia to draft a constitution for the new country, the failures of leadership were quite present in their minds. It had been decided that an executive should be open to impeachment. Franklin was looked upon to add the exclamation point to the question of executive permanence, which he did. What was the practice before in cases where the chief magistrate rendered himself obnoxious? Franklin asked rhetorically. Why, recourse was had to assassination, in which he was not only deprived of his life but of the opportunity of vindicating his character. It would be the best way, therefore, to provide in the Constitution for the regular punishment of the executive where his misconduct should deserve it, and for his honorable acquittal when he should be unjustly accused. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts rose amidst the intense humidity of Constitution Hall, closed off from the public at the height of summer to protect the secrecy of the proceedings, to suggest that the new nation's chief executive be removable on impeachment and conviction for malpractice or neglect of duty. Gerry was not alone in thinking an executive, a president, should be open to impeachment for what would amount to political malpractice. Virginia's George Mason agreed with Gerry. South Carolina's Charles Cottesworth Pinckney did not. Madison of the powerful Virginia delegation further specified why impeachment was an important check on a sitting president. It is indispensable that some provision be made for defending the community against incapacity, negligence, or perfidy of the chief magistrate, Madison said. The limitation of the period of his service is not a sufficient security. He might lose his capacity after his appointment. He might pervert his administration into a scheme of peculation, embezzlement, or oppression. He might betray his trust to foreign powers. Madison clearly believed the president could get lost in the position, misuse the power of the post, or simply behave badly. Should the term limit of 4 years be the only defense a nation has for ineptitude within the highest office, Pinckney feared a legislature that would hold the threat of impeachment as a perpetual sword of Damocles over the head of a frightened executive, thus limiting his independence and his ability to act boldly. Jerry excitedly rose to correct Pinckney. A good magistrate will not fear them, he instructed Pinckney. A bad one ought to be kept in fear of them. Jerry urged his colleagues to remember that a president should not fall under the maxim that the chief magistrate could do no wrong. Virginian Edmund Randolph chimed in to clarify one of the most prescient points of the debate. Randolph knew then what we know now. The most likely misuse of presidential power will stem from the ability to engage in expensive conflict, guilt, whenever found, or to be punished, Randolph said. The executive will have great opportunities of abusing his power, particularly in time of war, when military force and in some respect the public money will be in his hands. Little did Randolph know that America's executive and legislative leaders would later embroil the country in a permanent war state with escalating costs. Little did Randolph know that it would be in these times, and because of these times, that the leaders would so divest the American people of their constitutional liberties. Impeachment was included in Section 4, Article II of the Constitution. After even more debate, the grounds were also specified. The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for, and conviction of, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Some anti-federalists, such as Patrick Henry, Virginia's first governor, opposed the Constitution at first, believing the document still lacked the power to prevent or overthrow a tyrant and protect the rights of the populace. The newly United States, however, found it agreeable and it became the supreme law of the land. The following 13 presidents have had resolutions introduced to begin impeachment proceedings: John Tyler, James Buchanan, Andrew Johnson, U.S. Grant, Herbert Hoover, Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. Most efforts died in committee. Impeachment effort may backfire on Democrats. By Patrick J. Buchanan, there go the people. I must follow them, for I am their leader, is a remark attributed to a French politician during the turbulent times of 1848. Joe Biden's recent declaration that President Donald Trump should be impeached is in the tradition. Joe is scrambling to get out in front of the sentiment for impeachment in the party he professes to lead. Several factors surely influenced Biden's change of mind. Beset by gaffes and mental lapses while campaigning, which rivals like Senator Cory Booker, DNC, have seized upon to imply that Biden, at 76, is losing it and may not be up to the demands of the presidency. The former vice president has been on a steady slide in the polls. In early October, he was displaced as Democratic frontrunner by Senator Elizabeth Warren, Mass., and the $15 million Biden boasts of raising in the third quarter was eclipsed by the $25 million raised by Warren. Moreover, with Senator Bernie Sanders, VT, hospitalized after a heart attack, the possibility of a stampede to Warren as the socialist progressive flag bearer of the party has become real. Biden concluded that he could not remain ambivalent and allow his rivals to appear tougher on Trump, especially when the cause of impeachment unites and animates the party and media establishment as powerfully as it is. By taking his stand, Biden has made the question, "Where do you stand on impeaching Trump?" the big issue in the recent Democratic debate. Declaring for impeachment also gives Biden a way to deflect questions about what Son Hunter did for that $50,000 a month from a Ukrainian energy company while Joe was Obama's point man battling corruption in Ukraine. So it was that Biden came to tell a rally in New Hampshire, to preserve our Constitution, our democracy, our basic integrity, he should be impeached. He's shooting holes in the Constitution. We cannot let him get away with it. With polls showing a majority of Americans favoring an inquiry, and a Fox News poll showing a majority favoring Trump's conviction and removal, impeachment appears inevitable. What is Trump's defense strategy? Earlier in October, with a defiant letter from White House counsel Pat Cipollone dismissing the House inquiry as a fraud and a farce, Trump seemed to signal a strategy of massive resistance, wrote Cipollone. Your inquiry lacks any legitimate constitutional foundation, any pretense of fairness, or even the most elementary due process protections. The executive branch cannot be expected to participate in it. A few days later, however, Trump had backed away from Armageddon. His new position, if the full House votes to open an impeachment inquiry, and he is given the same rights and protections Richard Nixon was given in 1974, he, Trump, would respect House subpoenas, while retaining the right to challenge them in the Supreme Court. Thus, as Rep. Nancy Pelosi, DeKalb, and House Democrats seek to ram through a bill of impeachment by Thanksgiving, based on Trump's July 25 phone call to Ukraine's president, Trump is preparing for siege warfare. As Trump has himself conceded, impeachment is probable, even if the outcome of this historic collision between the president and Congress, which will decide the fates of Pelosi, Trump, and Biden alike, is, as of yet, undetermined. Yet, in this struggle, Trump is not without assets. The first is Rep. Adam Schiff, DeKalb, who has become the prosecution's face in the impeachment battle. This is good news for the White House, for Schiff's visceral hatred of Trump and desire to see him impeached, convicted, deposed, disgraced, and imprisoned is a matter of record. As long as Schiff heads up the impeachment inquiry, many will see it as simply a savage, partisan, and vindictive exercise. There are also two potentially explosive inquiries into the roots of the Mueller investigation that are well advanced. Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz has been looking into allegations that the FBI and Dodge abused the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to launch the probe and kickstart the Russia investigation. The Horowitz report is expected to be released within weeks. U.S. Attorney John Durham has also spent months investigating the origins of the counterintelligence investigation of Trump campaign aide George Papadopoulos. Among Durham's questions were intel agents of Britain, Italy, and Australia enlisted to spy on Americans by U.S. intelligence agencies. For any counterintelligence operation against a presidential campaign would have required a sign-off by then-President Obama. Administration officials have also told Fox News that when Robert Mueller met with Trump in May 2017, Mueller was pursuing the open post as director of the FBI, something the former special counsel denied under oath during his congressional testimony. Emails released this month through a Freedom of Information Act request by Judicial Watch indicate Mueller knew he could be named a special counsel if he wasn't chosen as FBI director. Russiagate consumed the first 3 years of Trump's presidency. Ukrainagate and impeachment give promise of dominating the fourth. Free speech group files brief in support of jailed protesters, by Glenn Allen, ESQ. The board of directors of the Free Expression Foundation, FEF, has asked that I explain the nature and importance of the amicus curiae brief that I, with a colleague, prepared and filed on behalf of FEF in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in October in the United States v. Mizilis, et al. Case. It is my pleasure to do so. Let me first describe the nature of an amicus curiae brief. Amicus curiae is a Latin term for friend of the court. An amicus curiae is someone who is not a party to a case, and who may or may not have been solicited by a party, who assists a court by offering information or legal arguments, typically presented in a brief, that bear on important matters presented in the case. Amicus briefs should not merely repeat arguments made by the parties but should bring to the court's attention issues the parties may have not addressed or fully developed. Amicus briefs require either the consent of all the parties or the approval of the court. The amicus brief F filed in October 2019 in the Mizilis case fulfilled the proper function of such a brief. The momentous question before the Court of Appeals is the constitutionality of the Anti-Riot Act, under which three young members of the Rise Above movement have been prosecuted and sentenced to several years in prison for their alleged involvement in the 2017 Charlottesville rallies. The defense counsel's briefs developed their arguments that the Anti-Riot Act is unconstitutionally vague and overbroad. FEF, however, saw a need to address other facets of the act not addressed by defense counsel. One of these was how American society has changed since the act was hastily passed into law in 1968. As FEF's brief states, the expansion of the internet and credit facilities have expanded the reach of the act into the mobile telephones in students' backpacks and the home computer in nearly every home. A statute intended to curb outside agitators who wish to incite riots now reaches nearly all citizens as they go about their ordinary daily activities. A second point FEF addressed involves the level of scrutiny a court should apply to its review of the act. The trial court had held that the act is content neutral and therefore not subject to exacting scrutiny. FEF contended to the contrary, the act is in fact not content neutral but disfavors a critically important kind of speech, the kind that arouses fervid emotions and spurs people to organize demonstrations and counter demonstrations, to travel sometimes considerable distances to those demonstrations, and to confront their adversaries in person. Strict scrutiny of the act, FEF contended, is therefore required. A third argument FEF presented is that the act violates the heckler's veto doctrine, that is, the doctrine articulated by the Supreme Court that listeners' violent reactions to protected speech cannot be a basis for suppressing the speech. The government's use of the Anti-Riot Act, FEF argues, gives enormous and illicit power to groups such as Antifa to intimidate persons from attending controversial demonstrations. Oral argument will probably be said in this important case in early 2020. It is unusual for amicus to be allowed to participate in oral argument, but I have nonetheless requested that I be allowed to participate. All persons concerned about free expression, especially free expression in demonstrations on controversial issues, should follow this case closely. Note that FEF's arguments in a California case helped sway a judge's ruling that the Anti-Riot Act is unconstitutional. We hope to convince the judge in this Charlottesville case to see things the same way, though only time will tell if he will see reason or be swayed by pressure by political correctness or the rule of law. Free speech isn't free, we must fight for it. By Glenn Allen, ESQ. There are overlapping networks of power in America today, run by savvy, active, unprincipled, ruthless people who give lip service to our robust free speech traditions but whose real aim is to prevent honest debate on controversial topics. Their modus operandi is to destroy those who dissent from the views they approve. They are highly skilled in crushing anyone who steps outside the narrow lines they draw. I know, I'm one of their victims, one of their many victims. On August 17, 2016, the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, published a distorted Hatch article about me and made it a news story in dozens of newspapers around the country. Within 2 days I lost my job, my reputation was destroyed, and I became a pariah in the city and legal community. The fact that I had worked zealously and ethically in my law practice and for the city of Baltimore was of no interest to the SPLC. Why would the SPLC care about such things? Its goal was to destroy a political nonconformist. As it happened, about the time the SPLC attacked me, I had been reading a book that contained a Russian immigrant's account of her life under the old Soviet regime. As I read that account again, I winced. Here is her account. I look at the people who support the transformation of America in disbelief. They are destroying the very land that gave them so much opportunity. In the USSR, representatives of the Communist Party were ingrained into every aspect of civilian, official, and military life. These political organizers controlled public order by observing the behavior and speech of every citizen. People who wanted a more secure and privileged life found it necessary to join the propaganda machine. In order to survive, citizens were silent out of fear of retaliation by the authorities. I winced because I felt I was reading a description of what life is becoming here in America under the growing domination of thought control networks like the SPLC. I shook my head. Could this really be happening in America? But it is happening, with ever-growing intensity. The critical question is, what shall we do about it? As Patrick Henry asked, shall we lie supinely on our backs until our enemies have bound us hand and foot? If we wish to be free, if we mean to reserve those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have so long been engaged, we must fight. I say we fight back. With your support, the Free Expression Foundation, Incorporated can be an effective means for doing so. Let's not lie supinely on our backs but stand tall on our feet, and fight. Please give your most generous donation today using the form on the facing page, Battling for Our Freedom of Expression, by Charles Randolph Shepherd. As I reflect on the one-year anniversary of the Free Expression Foundation's entry into the arena of First Amendment advocacy, I must first express my heartfelt gratitude to those who have answered the call to support FEF's endeavors. It takes a leap of faith to take a stand with a fledgling organization such as FEF. You have made that leap with moral and financial support, and I salute you. I want you to know your support has brought results. FEF, operating on a shoestring budget and in a difficult environment for the cause of free expression, can point to significant achievements in its short life. FEF filed an amicus brief over the government's opposition in California in opposition to the federal government's prosecution of Rise Above movement members under the Anti-Riot Act. As FEF, together with defense counsel, urged, the federal district court struck down the Anti-Riot Act as unconstitutional. The court's written opinion reflects the influence of FEF's arguments. This was a major victory affecting the future ability of protesters of all stripes to cross state lines to peacefully protest or support contentious issues. FEF also filed an amicus brief in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, challenging here as well the constitutionality of the Anti-Riot Act. Glenn Allen, the attorney FEF engaged to prepare its amicus brief, provides a more detailed description of FEF's amicus brief in an article on the facing page. FEF is providing support to attorney Glenn Allen in his lawsuit against the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC. After Mr. Allen filed his detailed complaint against the SPLC in federal court, which among other claims challenges the SPLC's 501(c)(3) status, the SPLC moved to dismiss. Mr. Allen vigorously opposed the motion. Although briefing on the SPLC's motion was completed in April 2019, the court has yet to rule. No doubt, many of the actions of the SPLC detailed in the lawsuit are disturbing to the court. Though the SPLC has an unfounded reputation as a champion of rights for African Americans and women, note that multiple reports in American Free Press over the last several years have exposed the SPLC as a money-making racket whose chief officers oversaw a toxic work environment for the very people the SPLC alleges it wants to help. AFP has also detailed actions by SPLC co-founder Morris Dees that have betrayed the high-minded ideals of the SPLC. FEF continues to provide moral and legal support to many other persons who have contacted FEF for legal advice, including a group of overpass warriors who wish to post banners of a political nature on certain highway overpasses but have been denied that right. We believe because their signs are not in congruence with the politically correct narrative that rules free expression in this age. FEF has momentum and is developing credibility. We need to build on this encouraging beginning. But it takes financial support to achieve this. In this regard, I am delighted to announce that thanks to generous donors, every donation FEF receives prior to November 15 will be matched dollar for dollar up to $2,000. Please remember that FEF is a 501(c)(3) nonprofit organization, and all donations to it are tax deductible in accordance with law. So now is a great time to double your impact. One of the premises on which FEF's mission rests is that First Amendment freedoms are fragile and currently face novel and formidable perils. New means of censorship, such as deplatforming, doxxing, and cyber harassment, have combined with age-old types of censorship, such as hectoring and ill-advised legislation, to create an atmosphere in which citizens have become fearful to speak their minds. At the same time, organizations that have traditionally defended unpopular viewpoints, such as the American Civil Liberties Union, are retreating from the First Amendment arena. FEF is not retreating but advancing. Please stand with us as we move forward in the cause of liberty. Thank you. Matching grants from two generous donors. Free Expression Foundation, FEF, is in need of operating funds, and we will gladly accept your sincere donations of any amount, none of which is too small. At this time, all of our officers are volunteers, accepting no pay for their efforts. However, there are legal expenses that cannot be avoided when fighting for a person's rights in court. FEF is lucky to have two donors who have agreed to make matching grants for the first $2,000 donations that are received by FEF. Use the form below and send your donation of any size made out to FEF to P.O. Box 1479, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20773. For those who can, please consider making a tax-deductible $1,000 or more donation and save on your 2019 taxes. Free Expression Foundation Incorporated, P.O. Box 1479, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20773. President Flip-Flops on Syria, U.S. Occupation is Not Legal, by Dr. Ron Paul. President Donald Trump is reversing his foreign policy decision so quickly these days that it almost seems like he overturns himself before making the decision in the first place. In early October, he was very clear that the U.S. was pulling its troops out of Syria, bringing soldiers home, he said. Let someone else fight over this long blood-stained sand. But then he overturned himself later in the same speech. He said, we've secured the oil and therefore a small number of U.S. troops will remain in the area where they have the oil, and we're going to be protecting it and we'll be deciding what we're going to do with it in the future. Where does Trump think he gets the legal or moral authority to send U.S. troops to illegally occupy foreign territory and determine what that foreign country can or cannot do with its resources? After 8 years of Obama's disastrous assault-must-go policy, during which the U.S. provided weapons and training to radicals and terrorists with a 500,000 people killed as a result, Trump had the opportunity to finally close that dark chapter of U.S. foreign policy so the Syrian people could rebuild their country. Instead, he sat down on with Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, who has been wrong in every foreign policy position he's ever taken, and decided to follow Graham's advice to take Syria's oil, even though Trump himself has said many times that ISIS is 100% defeated. He claims we must take Syria's oil to keep it from ISIS. The real reason the neocons want the U.S. military to occupy Syria's oil fields is they are still convinced they can overthrow Assad by carving out eastern Syria for the Kurds. They don't want to keep the oil from ISIS. They want to keep it from the Syrian government. They don't want the oil revenue to be used to help rebuild the country because they still want to make life more unbearable for the population through sanctions so they can overthrow Assad. They don't care how many innocent civilians die. So instead of bringing the troops home like he promised, Trump has allowed himself to be convinced to actually expand the U.S. presence in eastern Syria. Instead of ending a foolish mission, he's giving them an even more foolish mission, and sending in more troops and weapons. Instead of removing the approximately 200 troops in that region as promised, Trump is going to add more troops to equal about 1,000. He's also sending in tanks and other armored vehicles, according to the Pentagon. If Trump believes following neocon advice on Syria is going to produce results different than the past 8 years of following neocon advice on Syria, he's naive or worse. This new mission is going to cost tens of millions of dollars per month and will only serve to inspire the next generation of radicals. Trump is right that the people of the region, including Russia, Iran, Syria, and Turkey, have all the incentive to keep ISIS at bay. So why does he fold like a cheap suit every time the neocons strong-arm him into another dumb foreign policy position? Is pulling troops out of Syria a serious blunder by Trump? By Richard Walker. When the U.S. military pivots to protecting Kurdish oil fields instead of the Kurds, who face an uncertain future as they are driven from their homes by Turkish militias, are we witnessing a strategic blunder? Some retired generals seem to think so, though it is equally the case that their opinions are somewhat colored by the U.S. refusing to defend the Kurds from what appears to be a Turkish policy of ethnic cleansing. The Kurds were, after all, critical to the overthrow of the radical Islamic ISIS caliphate. Without the loss of 11,000 of their fighters and the 23,000 wounded, the ISIS collapse might have cost the United States a lot more blood and treasure. President Donald Trump's decision to move 1,000 mostly special forces troops out of Syria, while placing the fate of the Kurds in the hands of the Turks, was roundly condemned at home and by U.S. allies. Trump appeared to have made that decision without consulting his generals on the ground. If that seemed odd to some, his latest decision to insert half an armored brigade of 30 Abrams tanks into Syria to protect an oil field in the northeast of the country has many people shaking their heads. While Syria is not a major oil producer, those oil fields, presently being guarded by Kurdish fighters, will effectively be under U.S. control for the foreseeable future. Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, and other Middle East hawks in Congress, under pressure from Israel, persuaded Trump to take control of the oil fields to keep them from going back under Syrian control or being taken by Turkey. The theory goes that the hawks did it as a ploy to persuade Trump to re-establish a U.S. military presence in Syria. It has meant that the pullout has now morphed into an open-ended return of sorts to Syria. Therefore, while Russia and Turkey control a so-called safe zone that Turkey hopes to repopulate with 3 million Syrians living in Turkey by expelling the Kurds, the U.S. military will have a base of operations should hostilities resume with ISIS or others in years to come. If all this appears confusing, it is, for example, Trump, in one of his many tweets about his rapidly evolving Syria policy, suggested that the Kurds move to the oil fields area. It was a ridiculous proposal given that the oil fields are in a desert in which Kurds have never lived. Second, why would millions of Kurds move to a barren region with no infrastructure that has been the home of Arab tribes for centuries? That would create a separate conflict. Meanwhile, the Syrian government is happy to see the Kurds on the run, and so, too, are the Iranians, who watched the Kurds fighting alongside the U.S. military against ISIS in huge numbers. In Iraq and Syria, Turkey has what it wants and is using militias dominated by al-Qaeda and al-Nusra elements to force Kurds from their homes. Russia and Turkey have established an alliance to jointly run the area of Syria from which the Kurds are being expelled. At the same time, Russia remains a close ally of Assad's government, and of Iran, which has military personnel advising and supporting Assad's armed forces, a highly significant element in the unfolding Syria story that has been ignored by the mainstream media is the stark realization that the NATO alliance is crumbling. NATO was a prime mover in arming and training the Kurds in the battle with ISIS. It has had to take a backseat as two of its members, the US and Turkey, abandoned an ally. At the same time, Trump has refused to sanction Turkey for buying a Russian missile shield instead of the U.S. missile shield used by all NATO members. As the focus has remained on Syria, several thousand more U.S. troops, armor, and fighter jets have been moved to Saudi Arabia, with Trump remarking that the Saudis pay well. The positioning of more U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia raises the specter of a new conflict in the region. There are many who question why Trump should commit so many troops and material to the Saudis, given his professed desire to get out of foreign wars and bring our troops home. His Saudi policy stands in stark contrast to his promises. The answer is that he appears to have a special bond with the Saudi royals, made tighter by the closeness of his son-in-law Jared Kushner to Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman, who is generally regarded as an impetuous figure. The role of the U.S. military in Saudi Arabia should be a matter for Congress to explore, given the fact that the Saudis have been roundly condemned for a war they continue to run in Yemen and for their efforts to persuade the U.S. to bomb Iran. Media lies about Syria. By Philip Giraldi. Recently, the New York Times featured two op-eds by resident hacks Brett Stevens and Tom Friedman, as well as a featured editorial, all on the subject of Syria and how the Trump administration has betrayed the American people. The pieces were published back-to-back over the course of 3 days, clearly an attempt on the part of the editorial page staff to establish the paper's message on what the war in Syria was and is all about. All the pieces were riddled with inaccuracies and doubt and, out fabrications to support the false assertion that the U.S. intervention in Syria was somehow based on a desire to spread democracy and freedom while also serving some vaguely defined American national security interests. The New York Times is not unique in its defense of a hawkish and interventionist foreign policy, but itself describes as the newspaper of record based on its long existence and its location in the media capital of the United States. That means that it reaches a larger audience than most other media and also that it is regarded generally as credible. Therein lies the danger, as Times reporting and opinion pages will definitely have a major impact on how the public and even policymakers will regard certain issues. The Stevens opposite the editorial page and the Times editorial are worth examining, but the tone was set by the first piece to appear, by Friedman, entitled Trump's Syria Trifecta, a win for Putin, a loss for the Kurds, and lots of uncertainty for our allies. It's pure genius, even bearing in mind that the Times' reluctance to ever feature an article favorable to Donald Trump. The title of the piece is particularly scathing. Friedman began, on the eve of the Iraq War, in 2003, Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain addressed a joint session of Congress about America's foreign policy mission, in some small corner of this vast country. Out in Nevada or Idaho are these places I've never been to but always wanted to go, said Blair. There's a guy getting on with his life, perfectly happy, minding his own business, saying to you, the political leaders of this country, why me, and why us, and why America? And the only answer is, because destiny put you in this place in history, in this moment in time, and the task is yours to do. Blair is still right about the role that destiny has placed on America's shoulders, but years later it is also clear that many Americans are exhausted with that role. Friedman goes on to claim that the job of the president, though, is to balance the understandable desire of Americans to no longer bear every burden and oppose any foe to ensure the survival of freedom with the fact that U.S. interests and values still require us to remain engaged around the world in a sustainable way, with the mission in mind. He then accuses the White House of having failed to make fine distinctions, leverage allies, and amplify islands of decency. What does Friedman mean? First, that Washington's use of military force against ISIS, a legitimate and possibly even necessary objective, failed to comprehend the fact that in Syria ISIS was the enemy of multisectarian democracy, and so were Russia, Shiite Iran, Shiite Hezbollah, and the Shiite Alawite Bashar al-Assad regime, and they and ISIS all deserved one another. Per Friedman, defeating ISIS was actually counterintuitive, as it would reduce the pressure on Assad, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah and enable them to devote all their resources to crushing the last moderate rebels in Idlib, not sharing power with them. I feel terrible for the Kurds, but at least America might get the last laugh on Putin. Trump let Putin win Syria, and the indefinite task of propping up al-Assad's genocidal regime and managing Iran's attempts to use Syria as a platform to attack Israel, the Times commentator also asserts, as do many in Congress, that removing the Syrian government was good policy because doing otherwise sends a message to every U.S. ally, you'd better start making plans to take care of yourselves, because if Russia, China, or Iran decides to come after you or bully you, America does not have your back, unless you've paid cash in advance. He also quotes a self-described and inevitably expert Michael Mandelbaum, who makes the same point in his book The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. When we suddenly withdraw our support for an ally in one place, with no warning, we call into question our credibility everywhere. Mandelbaum, it should be noted, is a fixture at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, an institution that one might describe as a breeding ground of neoconservatives. Friedman fancies himself an expert on the Middle East and, to be sure, he has carved a lucrative career out of that conceit. But his principal argument, that Russia and Iran are enemies of the U.S. that must be opposed wherever they prop up while American troops should also stay engaged worldwide for reasons of credibility, doesn't really stack up, and he also falls for the moderate rebels and Assad as genocidal lines, which have been repeatedly debunked. Friedman does not understand that the United States would be far more respected, and credible, If it were to deal with the rest of the world fairly and honorably rather than blundering around using repeated threats of military intervention, in reality, neither Moscow nor Tehran actually threatened the United States, while it was Washington that was the destabilizing force in Syria by directly and indirectly supporting actual terrorist groups in a bid to overthrow Assad, an effort assisted by Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states, which also were supporting the terrorist groups in a bid to maintain chaos. Iran and Russia were only brought in by the legitimate government in Damascus to help defeat ISIS and also al-Qaeda-linked groups like al-Nusra. In spite of Trump's boasts that the United States defeated ISIS, it was really the hard and bloody work of the Syrian army and its allies who won the day. Friedman's belief that the United States must remain engaged worldwide because it is a force for all that is good to sustain freedom is, of course, palpable nonsense as the U.S. moves seemingly inexorably towards becoming a police state at home. Afghanistan has not been stabilized after 18 years of occupation. Iraq is experiencing demonstrations and rioting linked to the corruption that the U.S. introduced to the country, and a stable and non-threatening Libya was turned into a dysfunctional haven for terrorists and criminals through Barack Obama's regime change for the country. All of the above taken together as part of the global war on terror have killed as many as 4 million civilians and unleashed a wave of millions more as refugees that the world is currently trying to cope with. But perhaps the most laughable line in the Friedman piece is his citation of the need to prevent Iran's using Syria to stage attacks on Israel. The fact is that Israel, which is not at war with Syria, has bombed that country scores of times in the past 2 years alone, while Syria, and its ally Iran, have not even once attacked the Jewish state. To suggest that Friedman entertains a blind spot in a certain direction would be an understatement. Facial Recognition Coming to a Hardware Store Near You, by Dave Gallery. In the 2002 film Minority Report, Tom Cruise plays a police detective in Washington, D.C. in the year 2054, utilizing a prototype technology that prevents murders by employing three mutated humans, called precogs, who provisionalize crimes by receiving visions of the future. Would-be murderers are incarcerated before they can kill, which has reduced the murder rate to zero. The only problem is the system is faulty. The three precogs don't always agree. The federal government hides this fact in order to roll out the program nationwide, and the bad guys set up Cruz, who's uncovered the flaw in the system, forcing him to find a black market doctor to conduct an eye transplant to trick the citywide optical recognition system. The optical recognition system employs retinal and iris scans to identify every person who passes by one of the devices, and also matches the unique eyeball signature to advertisers, who pitch their products as one makes their way around the city. Nothing to worry about, right? It's science fiction, right? Wrong. In September, four Illinois residents who have frequented Lowe's and Home Depot stores in the Prairie State simultaneously filed virtually identical class action complaints against Lowe's in Chicago and against Home Depot in Atlanta, where it is headquartered, in federal court, accusing the home improvement retailers of violating the Illinois Biometric Information Privacy Act, BIPA, by surreptitiously scanning customers' faces with their anti-theft surveillance systems. BIPA is a 2008 law that protects against the collection and storing of biometric data unless customers are made aware of the electronic snooping. Illinois was the first state to regulate the collection of biometric data. Texas and Washington followed, but Illinois' law is the only one that allows individuals to file suit for damages, $1,000 per violation, and $5,000 per violation if the violation is intentional or reckless. Legislatures in Alaska, Michigan, Montana, and New Hampshire have all tried, unsuccessfully in 2016 and 2017, to pass similar laws. Retinal scans use the unique patterns of blood vessels to positively identify someone. Due to the sophisticated structure of the vessels that supply the retina with blood, each retina is unique, and although retinal patterns may be altered in cases of diabetes, glaucoma or retinal degenerative disorders, the retina typically remains unchanged from birth until death. Because of this, besides DNA, the retina is the most precise and reliable biometric measure, with a retinal scanning error rate of 1 in 10 million. The lawsuit claims that Lowe's and Home Depot have augmented in-store security cameras with software that track individuals' movements throughout the store using a unique scan of face geometry and surreptitiously attempt to collect the fingerprint of every person who appears in front of one of their facial recognition cameras, using these anti-theft surveillance systems to track shoppers across multiple stores and identify suspicious shopping activity. It also claims that the retailers have shared the facial scan information of its customers with others. Just 2 weeks before news of this lawsuit broke, it was revealed that Delta Airlines will start using facial recognition technology at one boarding gate at Los Angeles International Airport, LAX, which will allow passengers to confirm their identity with the cameras. Delta, with plans to permanently install the technology at 13 of its 21 boarding gates, is known in the airline industry for using cutting-edge technology and announced plans in June to install facial recognition cameras at 49 boarding gates at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and Salt Lake City International Airport. LAX has been used as a testing ground over the past year for facial recognition technology by various airlines and federal agencies, at three boarding gates at Tom Bradley International Terminal, including the Transportation Security Administration and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP. The technology matches departing travelers' faces with images and names in CBP's and other government agencies' databases. American Airlines is currently testing its facial recognition technology at LAX as well, and has revealed it is adopting facial recognition cameras to confirm the identity of international travelers at three boarding gates at Dallas Fort Worth International Airport. The technology is not without troubles, however. The Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General released an audit last year that found pilot programs to test the technology at 9 airports had a combined match rate of only 85%, below the agency's goal of a 97% to 100% match rate. The audit blamed poor digital image quality for difficulty matching travelers under the age of 29 and over the age of 70, as well as difficulties in matching certain nationalities, specifically U.S. citizens, Mexicans, and Canadians, because the government's digital gallery had fewer photos of those nationalities than of other foreign travelers. Best ideals of left are being usurped. Americans need to plug their ears to the siren song of radical identity politics. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. In the bad old days, choir boys were emasculated to stop their voices from changing. Imagine being a father whose sweetly singing son had been selected for the honor of mutilation. Could you stand against the powerful and connected, and against the dominant ideology of the age? In today's rational modern world, castrating a child would be viewed as horrific child abuse, yet psychologically castrating boys as young as 3 by branding them with a delusional diagnosis gender dysphoria, define his mismatch between the gender assigned at birth, that is, their actual, biologically determined gender, and the one they identify with, is now a lucrative gambit for the multi-billion dollar gender confusion industry. One of the victims of that industry, Jeffrey Younger of Coppell, Texas, is fighting back. See related story, page 25. Younger's 7-year-old son's life took a wrong turn when, at the age of 3, he made the mistake of dressing up as a female character in a Disney movie, and was subsequently dragged to the local gender confusion clinic to be diagnosed. Younger argues that his son is indeed his son, and that the boy's mother, Younger's pediatrician ex-wife, unhinged by transgender ideology, is turning the boy into an underage drag queen. The loony left, boosted by a complicit mainstream media, is trying to paint Younger and his supporters as the crazy ones. Why do today's leftists worship at the idolatrous altar of gender confusion? In his books The Wondering Who, and Being in Time, philosopher and jazz legend Gilad Atzmon argues that identity politics has usurped traditional leftist ideals of social and economic equality, peace, and justice. Before the triumph of identity politics, leftists struggled for a more reasonable distribution of income between haves and have-nots. They protested for peace and against imperial wars, and even their most unrealistic and utopian programs, misguided as some of them may have been, were inspired by an abstract ideal of justice, but as postmodernity eclipsed modernity, leftists stopped believing in such ideals as truth and justice. Their concern for the underdog shifted. Instead of trying to help the economically disadvantaged through progressive taxation, economic planning, and funding for education and infrastructure, leftists grew obsessed with fighting for allegedly oppressed identity groups. Women, even wealthy criminals like Hillary Clinton or Ghislaine Maxwell, were always members of a victim category. Homosexuals, no matter how rich and powerful, were also victims, likewise with wealthy, powerful, and or criminal members of other oppressed groups, whether blacks, Jews, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans, or people confused about their gender. The only group that could never include any victims was white, heterosexual men. The idea that reality is whatever you identify as is sheer lunacy. It opens the door to extreme phoniness and hypocrisy. Case in point, the politicians and other celebrities who identify as crusaders against climate change, even while living extravagant lifestyles responsible for vastly disproportionate carbon emissions. According to a recent study by researchers at Lund University in Sweden, outspoken climate activist Bill Gates was personally responsible for pumping millions of pounds of carbon into the supposedly endangered atmosphere, 16,000 times as much as the average person. Other celebrities who identify as climate activists were almost as hypocritical. Paris Hilton was responsible for more than 12,000 times as much atmospheric carbon as the average individual, while Jennifer Lopez weighed in at only 10,000 times as much carbon as you or me. Do Gates, Hilton, and Lopez have the right to identify as climate activists? Legally, yes. Delusion and hypocrisy are not crimes. If you call them delusional, does that make you a bigot? Should people who don't think Gates, Hilton, and Lopez are genuinely committed to reducing carbon emissions be forcibly silenced? It sounds crazy, but that is the direction America is moving. Those who refuse to embrace today's trendy orthodoxies are being vilified, shadow banned, and deplatformed. If you refuse to worship the wealthy, glamorous avatars of climate hysteria and gender confusion, you may find yourself ejected from Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and the rest of the digital commons. And even if you aren't ejected, it's likely that some right-thinking programmer working for the internet oligarchs will tweak their algorithms to make it harder for you to find an audience. Cultures that worship illusion rather than reality are on a collision course with collapse. Like the sirens in Homer's Odyssey, the loony left sings a seductive song promising us unheard of pleasures that will be ours if we abjure masculinity, forget about reality, and embrace the world of illusion. That castrato choir is quite seductive. To resist, Odysseus made his sailors plug their ears and tie him to the mast. Will our culture do likewise, or end up broken upon the rocks of history? Confusing time for males and females, hard to deny there's an agenda to feminize men and masculinize women, but why? By Donald Jeffries. Anyone who has watched a television show, a motion picture, or mainstream advertising over the past few years is all too aware of how our leaders view males, especially white males. The man has long been the butt of every joke in sitcoms, dramas, science fiction, and reality television. He is often portrayed as incapable of accomplishing the most mundane tasks without the intervention and assistance of non-whites and exasperated white females. Even children can outweed and outperform white males on screen. Watching men get beaten to a pulp by 98-pound females, or cowering in fear behind non-white males and aggressive, courageous white females, is something American viewing audiences now take for granted. All this was bad enough, but over the past few years, the transgender phenomenon has kicked in, with social justice warriors claiming there are 57 genders or whatever, with straight faces. In some school systems, the words boy and girl have been banned. More and more parents, led by deluded celebrities from Hollywood, are raising their children to be gender neutral. Some doctors are now injecting confused children with puberty blockers that delay the natural onset of each biological gender. This is allegedly to permit each individual to decide what sex they want to be, when the time is appropriate. This demented brave new world is now producing court cases in which mothers and fathers bicker over which sex their child will be. In almost every case, this has consisted of a mother claiming her often startlingly young son wants to be a girl, and demanding that the transition to transgenderism begin, while the father attempts to keep the child as the biological boy he unquestionably is. A high-profile case of this sort involves a female pediatrician in her quest to have her 7-year-old son, James Younger, become her daughter, Luna, and her former husband's understandable objections to that. A Texas jury recently inexplicably ruled in favor of the mother, granting her sole conservatorship of the child. Fortunately, a rational judge has now stepped in and reinstated joint custody of the boy. "We don't let kids drink alcohol till 21. People want to move smoking age to 21, but we will allow a 7-year-old to have his life and body altered like this. This is child abuse and the state should side with the father who is trying to protect the child," Senator Rand Paul, RCI, tweeted. The mainstream media has predictably left out the fact that the mother isn't connected biologically to the child, who was born via in vitro fertilization. A recent opposite the editorial page in the New York Times, of all places, focused critical attention on a bizarre new edition of Gentleman's Quarterly, GQ, once known exclusively for being a men's magazine. Author Matt Larbash noted that GQ's so-called masculinity issue was, according to its new editor-in-chief, attempting to challenge traditional notions of masculinity. Larbash compared singer Pharrell Williams's cover photo to Cinderella going to the Dick's Sporting Goods ball. The issue also includes a section on the glorious now of men in makeup, which features a trans model showing off mascara and lip tint. A conversation starter with 18 male participants reveals only 4 that are heterosexual cisgens, to use the acceptable politically correct terminology. One of the contributors, far-left comedian Hannah Gadsby, helpfully suggests that men scale back their confidence, and even refrain from sharing their opinions. A practice now seriously referred to in mainstream culture as mansplaining. A sculptor offers up some castrating humor. Clearly, there is an agenda within the schools, business world, government agencies, and pop culture to feminize men and simultaneously masculinize women. Forgotten is the sage advice of classical liberal Edward Abbey, who reminded us, "It is the difference between men and women, not the sameness, that creates the tension and the delight." We've gone from being unable to use the traditional term mankind, or even to refer to a manhole in the street, or to pronounce a couple as man and wife, to literally not being permitted to say a man is a man or a woman is a woman. Whites identifying as blacks, women identifying as cats and having surgery to make it official, middle-aged men identifying as little girls and being adopted by a married couple, all true cases. Is there any logical end to political correctness? What's to stop a poor person from identifying as a Rockefeller and demanding his fair share of the fortune? Whoever would have thought that the catchy transvestite anthem Lola from the Kinks, with its lyrical confusion, "Well, I'm not dumb but I don't understand why she walked like a woman but talked like a man," would become a reality in our crumbling country? Going soft on crime is dangerous. Violent offender who killed mother, child should never have been out of prison. By John Friend. A young child and a mother of 2 killed earlier this year by a serial criminal who was repeatedly given breaks by the criminal justice system has many concerned about the notion of criminal justice reform, long promoted by Democrats and most recently by President Donald Trump and GOP leaders. On April 19, Eric Ivall, Tanya Horn, and their young 8-year-old daughter really were in their 2013 Nissan Murano heading home after picking up their dog from the veterinarian in the metropolitan Oklahoma City area. Their vehicle was violently struck by a stolen pickup truck driven by Andrew Munoz, a 27-year-old with a lengthy criminal history. Riding with Munoz in the passenger seat was Deanna Alvarez, a 35-year-old woman who, according to Munoz's testimony to Oklahoma City police, was a high-ranking member of a drug cartel in the area. Munoz and Alvarez were fleeing from police at the time, who had attempted to pull over the stolen vehicle Munoz was driving. After initially slowing down and attempting to stop for police, Munoz sped off, leading officers on a high-speed chase. Munoz ran a stop sign and smashed into the vehicle driven by a van and occupied by both Horn and Young Reilly, killing the young child and her mother. Aval was pinned underneath his vehicle before being rushed to a local hospital, where he was treated for several serious injuries he sustained in the collision. He survived the devastating wreck, but his wife and young daughter tragically did not. A GoFundMe page has been established by a relative of Aval soliciting donations to help him with medical expenses. Investigating officers and first responders found close to 35 grams of methamphetamine on Munoz along with a loaded firearm. Alvarez also had a gun in her purse, additional methamphetamine and $4,000 in cash. It is believed the pair was involved in trafficking drugs at the time of the pursuit and fatal collision. Munoz told officers that Alvarez pulled her gun on him while he was driving and told him he would be dead if he pulled over for police. According to the Oklahoman, Munoz and Alvarez were charged with a slew of serious crimes, including first-degree murder, drug trafficking, illegal possession of firearms, and possession of drug proceeds. Additionally, Munoz faces charges of causing an accident without a valid license and unauthorized use of a vehicle. A concerned citizen and supporter of the Aval family set up a number of social media profiles to raise awareness of their plight and to highlight the dangers of so-called criminal justice reform, which arguably played a key role in this tragic situation. This reporter contacted this individual, who maintains the Twitter profile Justice for Reilly, at Reilly Justice, who agreed to be interviewed for this report anonymously. According to local media reports and court records, Munoz has been charged or convicted of 7 different crimes over an 11-year period, the source explained to this reporter. These include an armed robbery charge, case was dismissed, in 2008, a narcotics conviction in 2010, deferred sentence, aggravated eluding of police conviction in 2012, sentenced to 5 years, served 3, and convictions of obstructing an officer and unauthorized use of a vehicle in 2017. With his deferred sentence, he served 11 months and then was sentenced to 9 years probation. Our source provided more details about Munoz and his criminal behavior leading up to the tragic death of Horn and her young daughter. Despite committing basically the same crimes in 2017, he was given a lighter sentence than he was in 2012, the concerned citizen explained. I believe this is because of criminal justice reform laws passed in Oklahoma in 2016, specifically State Questions 780 and 781. To add insult to injury, in January 2019, Munoz was again arrested by police for driving with no license or insurance, a clear violation of his probation, yet was released. Predictably, he did not show up to his April 8 court date. On April 11, a bench warrant was issued for Munoz's arrest, yet it was never executed. 8 days later, Munoz would flee from police at nearly 80 miles per hour, striking the vehicle driven by Aval and occupied by his wife and daughter, killing them both. Our focus with this project is the criminal justice reform laws, the source told this reporter. Tanya and Reilly were failed by the state of Oklahoma again and again. Every one of those failures made that horrible day in April possible. This concerned citizen is aiming to pressure Oklahoma officials to conduct an investigation into Munoz's criminal background. Halt the passage of any criminal justice reform laws until that investigation is complete, and ultimately repeal the seemingly misguided criminal justice reform laws that likely led to the tragic death of Reilly and her mother. Additionally, Oklahoma should enact a law that ensures individuals with extensive criminal records who are on probation and are arrested again remain jailed until their court date. Stop poisoning water with fluoride. Activists battling court to stop powerful federal agency from fluoridating water. By Mark Anderson. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, maintains that fluoride prevents cavities. A long-cited but widely disproven benefit of this hazardous waste byproduct of aluminum in fertilizer production. Thus, the agency concludes, adding the chemical to public water is wholly justified, despite thoroughly validated scientific research showing ingestion of the toxin poses significant health risks to humans. A raging battle has arisen between proponents of the EPA position and critics working tirelessly to get fluoride out of our water supply. The common sense resolution to this battle is simply to stop adding fluoride to the public water supply and let those who believe it prevents cavities purchase bottled water containing fluoride, as is so often the case. However, in the United States we have it backwards. We must buy bottled water in order to avoid the fluoride that's dumped into many public water supplies. This conundrum has now forced the matter into the legal arena, and the Fluoride Action Network, FAN, is keeping up the fight in an effort to change the system for the better. In 2016, FAN and its coalition partners filed a petition asking the EPA to ban the deliberate addition of fluoridating chemicals to U.S. drinking water under Section 21 of the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, according to an October 22 article by Dr. Joseph Mercola of the Organic Consumers website. The EPA dismissed FAN's petition, prompting the consumer advocacy group and partners to file a lawsuit challenging the EPA's denial. Since then, a number of victories have occurred that are moving us closer to the goal of getting fluoride out of U.S. drinking water, the Upbeat report explains. The most recent victory came when the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California rejected an EPA request to delay the lawsuit's February 3, 2020 trial date, the FAN report notes. Not only does the victory keep the EPA from increasing the cost of the lawsuit by adding more evidence to examine and another expert witness to depose at the last minute, it also adds to the momentum our legal team has gained from four previous legal victories. The other four victories began in December 2017, when a court denied the EPA's initial motion to dismiss the case. Just weeks later, the second victory was announced, FAN campaign director Stuart Cooper wrote. On February 7, 2018, we won this second major legal victory. This time, EPA worked to prohibit our attorneys from obtaining internal EPA documents, and to prohibit our experts from relying upon recently published studies. Had the EPA prevailed, we would have been prohibited from including any new fluoride neurotoxicity study published after our petition was submitted in November 2016. Including the landmark U.S. government-funded 12-year study by Bashash et al. Published in September 2017. This study is critical in demonstrating that fluoride is neurotoxic and has no place in the public water supply. That study also showed that higher in utero exposure to fluoride is associated with lower scores on cognitive function tests in childhood, while the children's fluoride levels at ages 4 and 6 to 12 were not associated with their intelligence. The study found that exposure that occurs prenatally was linked to lower intelligence scores later. In fact, women with higher levels of fluoride in their urine during pregnancy were more likely to have children with lower intelligence, Cooper noted. In October 2018, the court ruled against the EPA a third time, ordering the agency to share its internal information on fluoride safety standards. The EPA's documents and correspondence relating to the specified studies are relevant to the ultimate issue the court must decide, whether the ingestion of fluoride in drinking water causes neurotoxic harm, the court stated. The fourth victory occurred in April 2019, when the court ordered the EPA to produce additional documents and scientists for deposition. Now, with the fifth victory denying the EPA's request to delay the trial for 65 days, the lawsuit is scheduled to begin as originally scheduled, on February 3, 2020. Notably, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as of 2014, 66.3% of the U.S. population received fluoridated water. In comparison, 97% of Western Europe's population drinks non-fluoridated water. Despite not fluoridating its water, tooth decay rates in these Western European countries are no higher than in the few Western countries, for example, the United States, that fluoridate their water, reports FAN. This raises serious questions about the CDC's assertion that the decline of tooth decay in the United States since the 1950s is largely attributable to the advent of water fluoridation. Vet's case shows danger of red flag laws, by Mark Anderson. A system that sinks so low that it meets out punishment even when no crime was committed and denies citizens due process is an unlawful racket bent on destroying individual rights and our constitutional order. A case in point is that of Stephen Nichols, an 84-year-old Korean War veteran who not only didn't commit a crime but was trying to prevent one, shines a bright light on the fallacies of red flag confiscation laws. Nichols, who served 6 decades on the Tisbury, Mass. Police Department, meaning he was a well-known, trusted member of his community, retired and began working as a school crossing guard. His unforgivable transgression was that he expressed concern about the safety of Tisbury school children after noticing that the school's resource officer, an on-site cop, would often neglect his duty to keep an eye on the kids by leaving the school grounds to grab a coffee at a nearby store. And what was Nichols's reward for such a clearly valid concern in an age of frequent mass shootings at schools and other vulnerable venues? He had his personal firearms confiscated by local police, even though he kept the guns at home and they had nothing whatsoever to do with the school or his crossing guard duties. He also was forced to surrender a firearm license that he'd long possessed. What's more, his crossing guard duties were suspended for a time. Nichols was eventually reinstated to his guard duties after his story went viral. A change.org petition in his support quickly hit and surpassed 2,000 signatures. The humiliating incident reportedly stemmed from a misheard conversation at a local diner, according to the Martha's Vineyard Times. When Nichols recently dined with a friend at Linda Jean's restaurant in Oak Bluffs, he chatted about the school resource officer taking his off-campus coffee breaks. After nearly a lifetime in law enforcement, the school situation didn't sit well with Nichols, who mentioned during casual conversation at the eatery that the resource officer's frequent absences would be a boon for anyone aiming to shoot up the school, but a waitress somehow misunderstood the conversation's context and reported what she thought she heard to the police. Yet, as clueless as the waitress was, there's no discernible excuse for how deplorably the police treated a former officer and war vet. Not long after the diner chat, Nichols was confronted by Tisbury Police Chief Mark Saloyo and another officer in the middle of his crossing guard shift. The two cops then drove Nichols to his house before seizing his guns and his firearm license. Without even receiving a receipt, Nichols was deprived of all of his weapons. And while Nichols wants the guns returned to him, it appears at press time that isn't going to happen. My grandson is manager of a gun shop in Worcester, Mass., and he's going to be allowed to come down and take the weapons and sell them for me, Nichols told local media. In a shocking twist, police never even charged Nichols with a crime. This lays bare the extreme risk that red flag laws pose to the most fundamental requirements needed for upholding our basic rights, that there must be a crime for there to be a penalty, that hearsay must not be allowed as evidence, that disarming the people, whether individually or collectively, in violation of the law of the land, which includes the Second Amendment, is itself a crime and applies to this case. When asked about Nichols and so-called red flag laws, Gun Owners of America's Texas-based spokeswoman Rachel Malone told AFP, "This is exactly the kind of scenario we said is going to happen. Legislators in many states are making it very clear they are talking about people who've not committed a crime. If any guy should be safe from something like this, it should be Nichols, but it clearly isn't. Therefore, no one is."